Right after the war in 1946, there was a referendum on statehood in which it was favored by a good 2 or 3 to 1. Of course, that didn't accomplish anything. But when it finally got serious was in the mid-1950s when they elected the Constitutional Convention, which was 55 people who met in Fairbanks in 55 and 56 to draw up the Alaska, what eventually became the Alaska State Constitution, which, with due credit to them, is regarded by a lot of people as one of the best and simplest, most straightforward state constitutions. Some of them go on and on and on, but ours is fairly nice and short and to the point. Two, maybe even three of the delegates are still alive, as is Katie Hurley, who was the secretary of the convention. One of whom was the still living delegates is George Sundborg, who was the father of my good high school and still good friend, Pierre Sundborg. But George was one of the delegates, George Sr., and he's well in his 90s now. And so I got firsthand reports from the floor of the Constitutional Convention, which got things hashed out by about the middle of 1956. And then there was I think still in 56, there was a territory-wide vote on the Constitution, which was accepted. And there were a couple of ballot questions on the same thing there, one of which was the fateful one that, I don't think, it wasn't part of the Constitution, but it was on the same election ballot, which was to abolish the salmon traps as soon as Alaska became a state. And they also, at that time, it was then that they elected two senators and a representative under what was called the Tennessee Plan, because the people in Tennessee pulled this off. Congress wouldn't make them a state, so they elected a couple of senators and sent them to Congress to lobby for it, and they were seated, and then they got around to making Tennessee a state. But the three that were elected weren't actually the three that eventually went to Washington. The elected senators were Ernest Greening, who was had been the territorial governor, and the other one was William A. Egan, Bill Egan, Eagle Bill, who wound up being the first governor, and E.L. Bartlett, who'd been the delegate in Congress, became the second U.S. senator, and Egan was governor, and Ralph Rivers was elected the first congressman. And so this was 56, so they obviously had to wait a while. And things proceeded apace in Washington, but it, both in Congress and in Alaska, it was a long process with lots of votes and things. And finally in 58, both houses of Congress approved statehood. Then Eisenhower signed the bill. I think that was about July or August of 58. And then in January 3rd, 59, was the great day when he actually signed the proclamation making Alaska a state. In the interim, there had been a vote on among the people of Alaska on statehood. And it was the first election I ever voted in, and I voted no, as did about a third of the people in Alaska, but ones with any sense.
Can you tell me why you voted no?
Well, I was just a general contrarian then, too. But there were actually some arguments against it at that time. For one other thing, I didn't care for some of the people that were very much for it. I'm afraid that's the kind of thinking I still haven't gotten away from. If so-and-so likes it, it must be bad. But, of course, at one time there had been a move to make Alaska into at least two states, one of southeast Alaska. That was when this was the economic center of Alaska, which was long ago now, but back when the canned salmon industry was to the territory of Alaska, what oil is now to the state. And a lot of people pointed out that as compared to other states in the West that had become states in the late 19th, early 20th centuries, Alaska wasn't getting a very good deal as far as a large share of the land in the territory went, which was true. To make up for that, they did get a very good deal on the mineral returns, which, of course, oil hadn't been discovered on the North Slope at that time, so the federal government didn't know how much it was going to be losing eventually by that very generous share of the mineral royalties going to Alaska. But I just felt that it had waited this long, and it could wait a little longer to see that they get a better deal on it. At least that was my callow reckoning at the time. But, of course, it was an idea whose time had come, and people wanted to be a state, wanted to have a 49-star flag and all of that. So I can't remember if it was after the election or because I wouldn't have been here during the winter, January 3rd, when the thing, I was in college at that time, when the statehood proclamation was signed. I think it was probably after the Eisenhower signed the bill in the summer of 58. Remember driving around with several of my friends, you know, honking the horn, because everybody in Juneau was driving around honking the horn, that kind of thing. That's what 20, 21-year-old chaps did in those days for big occasions. And so that was what I did during statehood.
Well, what was the mood in your family? Was it the same view that you had?
Yeah, my father didn't think Alaska was ready to become a state. The issue that really got him cranked up at that time was the first capital move thing came up promptly as soon as it became a state, because the state constitution says the capital of Alaska shall be at Juneau, in just those words, if I recall. And, of course, the first Anchorage-sponsored capital move thing came up and as soon as it became a state, and I think there was even a vote in 1960, but my father was very active in a group called Alaskans United, if I recall, which campaigned against moving the capital out of Juneau. And, of course, now, 50 years later, to all intents and purposes, Ms. Palin has succeeded in moving it out of Juneau. An awful lot of it has gone to Anchorage in the past couple of years. I mean, even more than was there before. But my father was also very much opposed to the abolishment of the fish traps, as were some people. That was one of these sort of issues that was, apparently people, or at least a lot of Americans, have to have somebody to demonize. And it was the canned salmon industry, the Alaska Steamship Company, and the Longshoremen's Union were the people Alaskans loved to hate in those days. And of course, the abolishment of the fish traps, and you can make arguments both ways. They were not the unmitigated evil that they're portrayed as now and weren't then. They were the most efficient way of means of catching salmon, at least the kind of salmon that go into cans. And that was what some people didn't like about them, and that and the fact that the money was being made outside. But the dire consequence of that was that when the fish traps were abolished, the big cannery outfits shut down and it essentially ended the dominance of the canned salmon industry.
Was the argument that the fish traps were depleting the resource?
No. Well, some people tried to make that. They could have done it. By law, for many years, they were closed on Sundays, and they could be cut down to one day a week, 2 days a week, whatever, of operation. Another argument was that, well, if fish traps are closed, all the seiners will get rich, and that didn't really work out either. A lot of people went, a lot of seine boats were built, and a lot of people went seining who maybe didn't have appropriate boats or didn't know what they were doing, and so that boom in seining didn't last very long. But the canneries had depended on both traps and the big outfits like Nacat Inlet, which was owned by A&P, the huge supermarket chain of that day. And they canned for a lot of other grocery companies. And Libby McNeil, which canned for lots of people. And those were two of the biggest cannery operators. They shut down. A Pyramid Cannery here in Sitka shut down in 59 or 60. As they'd had a couple of traps up just off Salisbury Sound. And so the other part of it was that traditional canned salmon was going out of style anyway, because they'd never modernized to the point where they could can it skinless and boneless. The peak years for canned salmon were the late 30s, around 1940, because that was poor people's protein during the Depression. It's hard to imagine that now, but it really was, and that was one reason the Depression wasn't that bad here. I mean, king salmon were a nickel a pound, but a hand troller could live on that in those days.
Do you ever think about how your life would have been different if Alaska had not become a state?
I don't really know that it would have been that different. Of course, one thing that we couldn't do as states, we had no voting representation in Congress, of course. We had a non-voting delegate who could take part in debates. But we couldn't vote for president and vice president and that kind of thing. And, of course, that was one of the things, come to think of it, that held up statehood. Alaska, hard as it may be to believe now, was solidly Democratic in the 1950s. I mean solidly. And it was all Democrats. And of course, Eisenhower was a Republican. And I think the Republicans were in charge in Congress. They were reluctant for that reason to make Alaska a state. A lot of the Southerners thought it was going to be a couple more Yankees making fuss about civil rights and that kind of thing. So a lot of the Southern congressmen and senators were opposed to it. So it wasn't considerable national interest at that time. But we were still liable for the income tax, and we were liable for the draft, which eventually got me. Well, I enlisted with the draft breathing down my neck a year or so after I got out of college. But so I really don't know that it would have made a vast difference to my life now, or it's hard to say what Alaska would be like now if that hadn't happened.
I sometimes hear people say that Alaskans had talked about joining Canada, and is that true? Is that the feeling that you got from people you knew at the time?
No. There was a crackpot group. I mean, Joe Fogler, up in your fellow Fairbanks, I believe, and his Alaskan Independence Party, they wanted to join Canada back in those days. No, I think the more serious effort, rather than joining Canada, which was pretty much of a fringe thing, was the possibility of making Alaska into two states, you know, probably just west of Yakutat. But and, of course, that never really got much traction.